I mean, like, if I were a peasant in that time, I would immediately just be like, cross myself and say, what is it
Hail
that,
Mary.
sure, say a Hail Mary, and I'd be like, I'm Catholic again.
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yep.
I'm not gonna lie. If I
Immediate.
watched Thomas Kramer burn at the stake, I'd be like,
Yeah.
I'm okay. Yellow leather, red leather, yellow leather, unique New York, unique New York. Which is
Yeah.
actually this. This is now the beginning of the podcast.
Sweet.
Hi,
Okay.
everyone.
So I say I'm gonna shave from the top. I'm gonna introduce it, right?
Well, I was about to do it.
Oh, so you just, but how do you wanna?
I mean, I can say my name first. Why does your name always have to be first, Will? I'm Andrew Panic. I'm very full of barbecue.
My name is Will Schaferman. It is Monday, February 24th, and this is the second to last week of Epiphany. And this is Excessively Anglican, a podcast for the Anglo curious. Blinded by the light,
revved up like a deuce.
Deuce two. So
another runner
did you
in the
get that
music?
one? Yeah.
No, I'm still thinking about it. I'm going, well, you know, but we have another like few weeks. So, I will.
Hey, Andrew.
How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great.
You know, at some point, this will actually be the first conversation we have in the day. No prep. Like no pre-conversation.
True.
Especially.
You know, the monks would not speak to each other until they did their prayers. And so there would be no preamble to human connection until they actually prayed.
That's kind of beautiful, but also I'm a big talker and that sounds really nerve-wracking. I think I would freak out if I couldn't talk to people. You mean like, did they ever have time that they were allowed to like be like, so Yusuf, that's not a monk name. What's a monk name?
Yusuf. You know, it depends on what order you're part of. So there are some like very strict Cistercians, which you think of the Trappist monks, that's the formal title, that are silent. You know, maybe in certain exceptions they'll allow it, but you don't speak to any other of your monks and you just pray, you go about your day, you work with your hands. There's actually a monk in Birmingham whose name is Father William Wilson. And he was for 20 years a Cistercian monk in, I think, like Kentucky or something like that. Silence for 20 years.
This is not today's topic, and maybe we can talk about it sometime, but I want to ask sincerely, is there really, that almost seems counterproductive to Christianity, because
I think I'm catching your vibe.
we're meant to live in community, and I mean, we have to share with each other. We have to share what we're going through. That's a huge part of it. And I'm not saying what they're doing is wrong, and I'd
Sure.
imagine that it isn't a very powerful way to grow your relationship with God, but you got to
It's
talk to people about it too.
kind of like taking the desert father approach to monasticism, where you get away into the desert, you're all by yourself, and it's just you and God, but it's putting that in the context of other people doing it at the same time. And I think there is, yes, I think it goes to the extreme. Would I ever want to be silent for 20 years? No. But it's a,
I'll bet your wife wishes you
it is a,
would.
it is a, oh, come
Ayo!
on. It is a corrective to, especially in the modern world, the incessant noise. And I
Sure.
think it goes to an extreme for sure. But it's a helpful, I think, just incarnate reminder of the importance of silence.
Are we going to do a staff retreat, a silent staff retreat sometime?
We should. I was just talking to somebody about
I know you've done that
a
before.
monastery that's about an hour north of here called St. Bernard's. Americans would call it St. Bernard's. And it's about, 60 minutes north in Cullman.
Okay.
And I actually went there maybe 4 years ago for a silent retreat. Really
Yes, you told me
powerful.
that story. You should share that sometime,
We should.
but not right now,
Not now.
because now I'm going to recap briefly what we talked about last week in case this is your first episode. Welcome,
Welcome.
all of you out there, tens of listeners.
One day it will be 15s of listeners.
It could be, maybe someday. So we talked about Anglicanism, what it is,
Yep.
We talked about the three sort of streams of Christianity, the sort of hierarchical Catholic Orthodox stream. Again, sorry for lumping those two together. They're very different. The evangelical word-based incarnation-focused stream and the Holy Spirit charismatic stream, and the way that Anglicanism sort of embodies all three of those, or tries to in its best form. As we established, Anglicanism is clearly the best denomination.
Yeah, of course.
Duh.
Yeah.
It's like, why would we even be doing this if it wasn't?
Well, as we'll get into later in the show, there's a really, really close relationship between Presbyterians and the Anglicans because of the Puritan heritage of Presbyterianism, which comes out of England and happens in the kind of post-Reformation era of Anglicanism.
I think what I'm hearing is that Will is very much itching to get into history, which is what we're talking about today. We touched on it a little bit last week, which for you may have been last week, or maybe it was 15 minutes ago when you listened to the last episode. But we touched on it a little bit, but there's a very rich history.
Yep.
And Will's going to kind of steer the ship on this one and take us on a little tour. So we talked about sort of how it got started. My joke that's not a joke was like, why would you want to be a part of a denomination that literally exists because a king wanted a divorce? Mm-hmm. You told me that, well, there were actually Christians in England in the 100 AD.
Yeah.
Which is, the Gospels were written when? The 60, like 60 AD, something like that?
Yeah, and then John was later, but yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
So go forward from there. Yeah. Tell me about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, yes. Yeah. So we left off with Henry VIII, right? Where Henry opens the door to reform. He sets up Thomas Cranmer, who is the first Archbishop of Canterbury, kind of the big dog, right after they break from Rome. He's the first one that is in the independent English church.
Anglican Pope?
Nope.
Why did he not just call him the Pope? Why did he not just, was he trying to like not make the real Pope more mad than he already was?
Well, I suppose because it's a different theology, you know, the Pope was the, not just an archbishop, but he's chief among even all the archbishops. And the theology at that point, the Pope had become very wonky in terms of like infallibility and seeing the Pope as this supreme being almost.
The vicar of Christ?
Yeah. And that's another episode for another time. But yeah, so we left off with that being sort of the way in which Reformation starts to happen in England. But there's a whole lot of history that follows where what began with Henry VIII becomes solidified. And so what we'll do today is basically take you from 1534, which is the moment where, you know, the divorce or annulment happens between Catherine and Henry.
Sorry, annulment.
Till now. Because the real question we want our listeners to hear today is, how did we get to right now? Like, how did we get to 2025, Andrew and Will sitting in chairs, launching a podcast about Anglicanism?
What would King Henry VIII have thought about our question. Podcast?
He probably would have thought it was
the greatest podcast of all time.
About everything.
Would he have said, how are you talking when you're over there and you're also over here, and then accused us of witchcraft?
That actually may not be too far from the truth.
Yeah.
But okay, so I'm going to turn my page, so I have a couple notes that we'll walk through. But
yeah, I have the same notes.
After Henry VIII, who comes next, Andrew?
King-wise?
Yes. But trick question, queen-wise.
Oh, Elizabeth I?
Nope.
I have no idea. I'm American.
What is your favorite brunch drink that has red tomato juice in it?
Michael's favorite drink, my brother, is a Bloody Mary.
Okay. So Mary is the daughter of Catherine. So remember, he divorces, he annuls his marriage to Catherine, and after he dies, so I think 1553 is when Henry dies.
Wasn't the point of all of that so he could have a son?
What's that?
Wasn't the point of all of the divorce and everything so he could have a son?
Yeah, so of course, yeah, I skipped over the fact that for a brief period, like 6 years, Edward, his son, reigns, and he continues to propel forward this Reformation. This is during the time when Cranmer is putting out the Book of Common Prayer. We'll talk about that another time.
So how did we get Mary then? Did he die?
So Edward dies as a young boy. Like he's only, and he's, I think he's 9. You'll have to fact check me, but I think he's 9, maybe 11 when he's the boy king. And in fact, during his inauguration, Thomas Cranmer, the archbishop, preaches on Joshua, the young boy king of the Old Testament, as a way to compare what's happening in the contemporary moment.
That's almost kind of sweet and really sad that he died so young.
He had a lot of health issues, died young, and then Mary, who would have been his relative, relative connection is, but she's the
great aunt twice removed.
She's the daughter of Catherine of Aragon. And remember, Catherine was spurned, and so Mary has a chip on her shoulder.
This almost seems biblical.
Oh, yeah.
You think about, Abraham and Sarah, and then also Hagar. Like,
there's rejection happening.
Yeah.
Sons involved, children involved. Yeah. And so Mary comes to the throne, and she's deeply, like, staunchly Roman Catholic.
Oh.
And so all of a sudden, this Reformation happening in England comes to a sudden halt. She reconnects England to Rome. For the 6 years that she reigns, 5 or 6 years, she is no longer declaring England as a sovereign power when it comes to religion. So they come under the Pope again, and it's this whiplash happening. And Mary kills off all the leading lights of the Reformation. So Thomas Cranmer is burned at the stake.
Oh my gosh!
Thomas Cranmer, in fact, he was very human, right? So he... Initially, he's imprisoned. He's in terrible conditions. He's weak. He hasn't been fed healthy food. He hasn't been probably had food or water in days. And he recants his Protestant faith. And it's this shocker. All of a sudden, the leading light, the archbishop of the church in England, recants his faith and in order to save his own life. But then he recants on his recantation. And he's immediately driven to the stake. He's taken... They set up the pyre, and Cranmer, in order to, in a last-ditch effort to compel people toward the Protestant faith, says to those gathered, "This is the hand with which I wrote my recanting. Like, I penned this out. This is the first part of my body that will burn." And so he puts his hand into the fire, and then the rest of his body burns.
That is hardcore.
Hardcore. And then, of course, the other two guys, which were basically his lieutenants, who he had known since his days as a college student, which are Hugh Latimer, which was a big theologian, pastor back in the day, and then Nicholas Ridley. Those were the two top dogs with him. Mary kills them too. And then all of a sudden, it feels like the hope for England when it comes to the Reformation is dead. Like, if you're living in that moment... You think, oh, this was nice. Everything's gone. And it's a moment of, you should stop and think, like, there are moments in your life where you just hit a complete wall, where what was really good stops suddenly, and you think the world is over. Like, things are just done. But 5 years later, Mary dies, and Elizabeth comes to the throne.
I mean, like, if I were a peasant in that time, I would immediately just be like, cross myself. And say, what is it?
Hail Mary.
Sure, say a Hail Mary, and I'd be like, I'm Catholic again. Yeah. It's fine.
Yep.
I'm not going to lie. If I watched Thomas Cranmer burn at the stake, I'd be like,
yeah,
I'm okay. Yeah. Really, actually, Catholicism. What did, like, I mean, do you know what the general attitude was? Because we're talking on an order of how many years?
For what?
That from the time... That
Mary Cranmer to the throne?
No, from the time that Cranmer was established Cranmer. As Cranmer?
Cranmer. It's Cranmer. A hard one. It's a hard one.
Well, this is a lot of
people will say a lot of people will say Cranmer. Cranmer.
Cran.
It's Cranmer. Think of cranapple.
I was gonna say it sounds like a variety of cranberry juice. Yeah. Cranmer.
Yeah.
Cranmer juice.
Yeah.
So Cranmer. I'm Cranmer. Glad this is permanently on a podcast. Cranmer.
Yes.
Somebody else probably had the same question. from the time that he was established as the archbishop to him burning at the stake.
Yeah, so it's a great question. You'll have to look it up on Google.
But 30-ish years?
No.
Less?
I'm going to say 20.
Okay, so my point, the only reason, like, the exact doesn't matter, because my point is, like, for the common person in an age where information did not spread like it does today, like, how much hold had Protestantism even taken?
Mm-hmm. With the people themselves, probably not much.
So it didn't feel so
whiplashy for the common person.
Yeah.
I think for people that were involved at the high level, of course it did. A lot of people's heads got cut off. Anne Boleyn, of course, died. She was executed in the Tower of London. But yeah.
They killed that preacher the other day. That was crazy. What was that about?
Yeah, right. I do think, you know, Reformation in England, and we'll get into this, it takes a long time to seep into the churches and to the people in mm-hmm. them, for them to get used to hearing the scriptures read in their own language, because they're used to sitting in church hearing the Latin read and just basically having their own personal devotions while the priest is kind of performing his stuff up front. They're sitting there, they're maybe going through their prayer beads, they're maybe saying Our Father, but they're not engaged in the service. All of a sudden, Cranmer issues the Book of Common Prayer. He has liturgy that's in the vernacular. They're supposed to have call and response. They're supposed to be engaged. That's a big shift from what you understand to be church. Yeah. And so initially you have to think it was probably met with pretty substantial resistance.
Oh, I'm sure some people didn't like it.
No. So Mary dies and Elizabeth comes to the throne. And whereas Edward was, I think, 6 years on the throne, Mary was 5, Elizabeth was there 45 years.
Okay. That's like a reasonable reign.
So she brings this stability. She brings this period where there's been a back and forth, where there can be a solidification of what is this thing that we call Christianity in England? Is it Catholic? Is it Protestant? Is it something else? And really what happens is Anglicanism during those 45 years begins to understand itself, and certainly on into the next 100 years after that, as a middle way. This is when Anglicanism becomes defined as this middle course between full-throated Protestant Reformed theology, John Calvin, stuff that's happening on the continent, and its Catholic heritage. And this is a period where different people are talking about the church fathers and how those influence how we understand the church, going back to the sources, if you will. And all of that is informing what people begin to understand as their new heritage to offer ultimately the world. So Elizabeth's there, and as you turn the corner, she dies in 1603, and as you turn the corner from her life into the 17th century, you start to have tensions rise, right? Because if you've defined Anglicanism as the middle way, then there are going to be certain people that take that and emphasize one side of that, which is the Catholic, and certain people which emphasize the Protestant. It sounds a lot like 2025, doesn't it?
Sure.
And in the 17th century, those two groups were known as the Caroline Divines and the Puritans.
I've heard of them.
Okay, so the Caroline Divines.
No, I've not heard of them.
Do you know where the term...
I've heard of Puritans, though.
Do you know where Caroline comes from, that the name... Not in this context, but just in general, where Caroline, my daughter's name, Caroline. No. So Caroline is just the Latin form for Charles. Charles, Carl, Caroline.
Oh, okay.
So King Charles I, during his reign, there's a group of theologians that are all leaning toward the Catholic side of the Anglican heritage, and then you have the Puritans, which are like, this is way too much. We need to get it even more reformed like we have on the continent, like John Calvin, all that. And there's this great tension that's rising, and that continues and crescendos to the English Civil War. So there's this period of history. I don't know how well you learned this when you were a boy growing up in your history class.
No, and I have to remember that not everyone's going to watch the podcast. There's a look of shock on my face that the division between the Anglicans was such that it caused a civil war.
Yeah. I mean, it was one aspect of it. There's other tensions flaring, but that was certainly a strong part of the development of it.
That's just kind of wild.
It's kind of wild. And what happened was the king at the time, Charles, was more of a Caroline Devine type. He was more of the middle way slash Catholic side of things. And a lot of the folks in Parliament were more puritanical. Like they were pushing back against him. And then there were some tensions in the political sphere unrelated to the religious side of things. And out breaks this war. And what happens during the Civil War, but something that you would really appreciate, and a lot of us appreciate. What is the first non-biblical source of theology that you studied as a Presbyterian growing up?
Probably the Westminster Confession
of
Faith. All right.
Right. So
I've noticed that Westminster sounds very English.
It does sound very English.
For it to be like sort of the one of the leading guiding documents of the Presbyterian Church.
Yes. So
tell me about it. I'm excited. I'm on now. Here we go.
This is why Presbyterians and Anglicans are so linked at the hip. So you have the Westminster Confession of Faith is written during a roughly like 10 to 15 year period during the English Civil War.
And by Anglicans.
By Puritan Anglicans. So by those that are pushing back against the Catholic Anglican side. And because Puritanism has taken such a hold in Parliament, it's passed. Like the act that basically enshrines the Westminster Confession of Faith as like the theological basis for the church in England is passed. I'm going to say 1549, but you'll have to – I'm not 1649. You'll have to get me on that. I don't have it written down here.
I might be jumping really far ahead, but we talked very briefly about – and it honestly could probably be its own episode, but we talked about the Westminster – for those of you out there who may not know, is this really, you don't have a copy, do you? No, you're too Anglican. It is this huge book that has, you know, it's sort of a catechism. It has questions and then answers. The first one is, what is the chief end of man? And there's also a shorter catechism, which is an abbreviated version, but like the answer to the first one is to glorify God and enjoy him forever. Mm-hmm. If you look at the actual Westminster, it is this huge, mm-hmm. like, long thing with all these scriptural references, which is a wonderful document, but it seems not very Anglican, seems not very accessible, and it really it's almost a little bit Enlightenment-y in that it's tries to really codify everything, and it sort of removes some mystery. And so when do the 39 articles come into play? Am I skipping ahead?
Well, no, you are raising an important question, and that is the difference between Puritan Anglicanism and what becomes sort of middle way Anglicanism. So actually the 39 articles happened during Thomas Cranmer's day. So we didn't mention this, but I think 15 Book of Common Prayer is 49 and 52. It was somewhere around that the first set of articles, I think they were actually initially called the 42 articles, and then
three of them didn't make it.
They abridged. And it becomes the 39 articles. They are during Elizabeth's day. They are these sort of solidified. And in fact, after Westminster happens, I think it's Westminster again. I think it's 1649. Don't nail me down exactly. But that's right when the interregnum happens. So I don't know if you know.
The what?
Yeah. So inter, in between, regnum, kingship.
Oh, like
so between the
regime.
Yeah, basically, but it's when the crown, I don't know if you know this, but in England, there was a 10-year period where there was no king.
The best period.
The best period. Oliver Cromwell, that sound familiar?
Yeah.
Okay, so he was the like Lord Protector, but he wasn't king. They took down the king, and they had this period where the parliament was really in control, but they had this guy representing them, and during that period, you had the Puritans basically taking over the Anglican Church. And they think they've kind of won. Chaos ensues. Charles's son, Charles II, actually comes back into power. But it's after he comes back that you have a full stop, like, we're not going to ever do that again. And so the Book of Common Prayer, that this gold standard for it is endorsed during his day, 1662.
That is the
sort of, if you look back on when somebody says, when was the Book of Common Prayer written? It wasn't written then.
But
that is the full expression of what the BCP was supposed to
be. And
did
it include the 39 articles?
Yeah. I think they had it at the back.
Yeah.
And but that was the moment that after all the chaos ensued of the Civil War and then the interregnum, things get back on track with Charles II.
That's really weird to me because I once went without a manager at my corporate job for 6 months. It was the best 6 months. We got so much done, and then we got a manager and everything just slowed down again.
Those kings, you know.
So, yeah.
Yeah, you know, the history of the world, King Jesus.
The
history of the world would have been very different if there was no monarchy in England.
Yeah.
The British Empire, as we know it, probably doesn't happen without that.
Mm.
But I digress.
We're Americans.
America.
Merca.
All right, so...
Yeah, sorry. So...
So we have...
The Westminster...
Confession, Interregnum, all of that. I should mention the Caroline Divines. These are some of the, like... greatest mind that Anglicanism has produced. So if you're curious to like go back and read some literature that defends why the Anglican Church retains its Catholicity, meaning its connection to the original church and doesn't swing all the way to the other side, people like Lancelot Andrews and Jeremy Taylor, some of the best poets of England of all time that they've ever produced, people like George Herbert, John Donne, they're all during this time. And so it's this flourishing of literature, flourishing of the written word with regard to Anglicanism. You know, one thing that you'll often hear people talk about is that Anglicanism is often associated with beauty. And that shows itself through the English poetic tradition. You know, sure. Some of the best poets are just, and you can actually make connections between the Book of Common Prayer and some of their poems and just the way in which the Book of Common Prayer is so formed.
It is exceptionally beautiful. If you're listening to this and you are Anglo-curious, or even if you're kind of not, and I don't know who got you to listen to this, but read some of it.
Yeah, and some of the most talked about novels in English history, you'll see different language forms that are you can make the connection between
Lord of the
liturgy.
Lord of the Rings? I mean, sincerely.
Well, kind of. He's Catholic. Tolkien was Catholic.
What?
Yeah.
No. All right. We're getting off kilter here. I don't know. I need to know about that. But
yep.
Okay, so let's, I see on my notes, I see America.
Yeah. We need to go there.
And I want to know about America. Because again, and I sort of mentioned this before, but before Will ever called me, before I ever went to an Anglican church or whatever, I thought it was super weird that the Church of England had a presence in America. I was like, why?
Mm-hmm.
I understand a lot better now. And hopefully if you're listening, you do too now.
Yep.
But not only did it have a presence, it's actually kind of deeply ingrained in American history.
Yeah.
So how did it get there in the first place?
Yeah, so the big shift happens in 1607. Do you remember your history class on this?
I don't, but fortunately I have a note that tells me that's when Jamestown was established.
Yes. Right, so this is the first time that Anglicanism meets the shores of the New World. You have the Jamestown settlement. The moment they get off the boat, they have a prayer service. And where does it come out of? The Book of Common Prayer.
Wow.
And from that point onward, Anglicanism becomes effectively the established religion of the land, of those colonies, and especially in the Mid-Atlantic region. Virginia becomes the hotbed of Anglicanism and still is to this day, and there's more that we'll talk about toward the end of this. But from 1607 until 1776, obviously you know that date, there's a development of this religion that comes from England that starts to have tension because what's happening? We're pulling away from England. And in 1776, I'm skipping ahead a little bit, but the Anglican Church in the colonies becomes rebranded. It becomes the Episcopal Church in the United States of America.
Because they don't want to have England in their name.
They don't want Anglicana.
Rightfully so.
That's right.
USA.
And so they just brand themselves effectively as the church that has bishop. So Episcopal Church, episkopos is the Greek word for bishop or overseer in the New Testament. And so they're just like, well, I guess we'll just name it by its form rather than its origin.
Which is more common for Protestant denominations, Presbyterian.
Methodist.
Methodist, yeah.
Sure. Yeah, that's fair. So you have this happening in America, and this is happening in other areas. You know, the East India Company is starting around this time too, Jamestown time, 1600s. And you when British people go abroad, they bring their religion with them. And so it happens in America, happens in India, eventually gets down to Africa. And as we turn the corner into the 18th century, 1700s, you have missionary efforts beginning across the world. And they bring with them, just like the Catholics would, their particular flavor of Christianity.
Sure.
And it just becomes known as the Anglican Church in fill in the blank. So you have the Anglican Church in Rwanda and Kenya. And initially, it's British white dudes that are leading the church there. But over the course of, as you especially get into the 19th century, leadership is nativized. And they turn over the reins to local leaders. And it becomes truly its own independent body. I'm skipping ahead a little bit. But this is how that we begin to think of the Anglican Church as this global tradition. You had a question.
Well, I was just, no, more of a comment is just that I think that that's, I don't know if that's uniquely Anglican or not, but I think that's so important and something that we could dig in maybe too deeply. Maybe it's more for another time, but Tim Keller makes a really good point in his book, The Reason for God, that a lot of people, especially maybe atheists, will make an argument that the evangelizing of nations is inherently oppressive. Mm. Basically, that it's a tool. It's only a tool that people use.
Cultural imperialism.
Yes. Yeah. To then, you know, take over resources. Does that happen some in history? And maybe today? Maybe. Yes. But they're also, you know, very genuine people that want mm-hmm. to spread the gospel. Yep. And moreover, Tim Keller's point in that book is how Africans, by and large, have always been very spiritual mm-hmm. people. Their individual cultures, which that's a very, obviously to say African is very, very broad. There's 56 countries. But generally speaking, you have, you know, very spiritual cultures mm-hmm. and to say sort of to try to evangelize, if you will, atheism would not resonate with them.
Sure.
They would say that wouldn't even make sense because that's not their framework for how anything works. Whereas Christianity in its best form, the way it should be presented, is a fulfillment of what they already know to be true.
So good.
Rather than this cultural overtake. So all of that was a bit of a tangent just to say, you point out that the individual churches of different countries, the Anglican expression there becomes localized, nativized. I think that's a really important aspect to show that, you know, Christianity is for the nations, and it does not carry, even within Anglicanism, does not have to carry this implicit culture, only the truth about reality as is expressed in the Bible.
Yeah, that's really good. And actually, when you get into the 19th century, and I'm skipping ahead here, there's one thing I want to mention finally about 18th, but 19th century, that's when you have the abolitionist movement. And Anglicanism is at the heart and soul of abolishing what really rose up within England, the slave trade in America. But one thing just to note, and just in terms of like huge thing you mentioned, Methodism, in the 18th century, you have the First Great Awakening. And of course, that's happening in America. It's happening over in England. John Wesley, William Whitfield, these guys are towering figures within the Anglican Church. Of course, Wesley ends up, he dies an Anglican, but he launches this new sort of, you know, child, what do you call it? Offspring denomination of Anglicanism, which we call Methodism.
Funny how that happens.
Now, John Wesley, I think, preached 50,000 sermons in his lifetime, which if I preach every Sunday for, let's say, 30 or 40 years, I think that's down to like maybe 3,000 or 4,000 sermons. You just got to think like he was preaching every day. I'm dying when I'm preaching every week for a year. So, I mean, just the output that these guys had, the spiritual vitality, they would go, you know, the reason Wesley ruffled so many feathers was he was an anti-establishment dude. Like, he would go and preach in an open field, and it just wasn't deemed appropriate. It was too energetic. It was
so funny because
enthusiastic.
That just feels like the same things they said about Jesus.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we talked about this at the end of our podcast last time, but that was basically, what are some of the challenges inherent to Anglicanism? One of the parts of the Catholic side of our heritage that's could be an Achilles heel if we're not careful is that there can be an inflexibility. If you lean too hard into the Catholic side of things, you can want stability of the institution over mission and over adaptability to the needs of the people and to be able to speak the gospel to different cultural contexts. Wesley was pressing up against that institutionalism, and that's why he ends up spawning this different denomination. But that's the big high note, I think, from the 18th century in terms of the Anglican Church. But as we turn into the 19th, the high note there is the launching of really what we come to know as evangelicalism or evangelical Anglicanism. This is people like William Wilberforce and the Clapham sect, a group of people that were kind of high society. William Wilberforce was a member of parliament. He was the big abolitionist. The Clapham sect was a group of wealthy aristocrats who wanted to reform the culture of England for the gospel. And they launched, I think it was like 50 different parachurch ministries, different nonprofits effectively, that either were like missionary efforts, like the SBCK, which is the one of the big missionary wings of the Anglican Church. I think
still?
I think it's still around, or it's maybe been rebranded, but it's the Society for the Propagation of Christian Knowledge, SBCK.
Hmm. This is cool. All of this sounds very modern.
Yeah, and like you're getting into the modern. This is an Industrial Revolution. They're spawning all these different nonprofits that are just blessing the common good of the land and beyond. And of course, William Wilberforce takes on abolitionism. That's his thing, his whole career. And he dies just after the passing of the law that enshrines the
13th Amendment?
In England, though.
Oh, in England.
In England.
Oh, okay.
And so Anglicanism... Yes, we were complicit.
Oh, right, because we're still
days
in the
of slavery. But then he and a group of Anglicans undo it. So anyway, it's a big deal. But evangelicalism begins to spawn in the 19th century. One of the big figures during this time is Charles Simeon, big preacher in Cambridge, was there for like 50 years at a church locally there. But this is where you begin to have this non-Catholic, not quite Puritan, but more enthusiastic low church movement within the Church of England. And it becomes really the foundational schema for how evangelical Anglicans today think. And J.C. Ryle is another one. There are a bunch of Anglicans.
John Stott?
Well, he would have been the 20th century, but he is a descendant, descendant of those guys. And but with every reaction, there's an equal and opposite reaction.
Sure. Right?
And so you have evangelicalism coming about in like the 1830s and to like the 50s and 60s. Toward the end of the 19th century, you have a reactionary movement against that called the Oxford Movement. It's a group of theologians in Oxford and sometimes it's called the Tractarian Movement. So they have these tracts, these written little pieces denouncing evangelicalism and saying why the Church of England should be high church again. And it becomes the basis for what a lot of what we know to be like high church Anglican church today is founded from. So, you know, you have these two sides, the two poles that we talked about last week, beginning to really be codified in the 19th century. The Tractarian movement gives birth to the high church movement, which continues to this day, the evangelicals in their own way. And as we turn the corner into the 20th century, those will be very important because the church begins to be impacted by what we call theological liberalism. But before we get into that, stop. Any like reflections. Yeah, it's a lot of stuff that I threw at you.
I was just going to say, it's so funny that people that are so similar.
Yeah.
Are at such odds.
Yeah.
You have, I mean, there's the initial split from Catholicism, and we've sort of talked about that. I don't think we talked about it on the podcast, but you and I have talked about it personally, that one of the beautiful things about Catholicism is that it has been a fairly unified, relative to anything else, a unified body for 2,000 years. Yeah. And it's a shame that there's so much division, but at the same time, I think there's like a beauty. I think we can trust God that it is eventually working mm-hmm. for good, like mm-hmm. anything else. And it's been seen, you know, we've seen some of the good that's come from it.
Yeah.
And hopefully there's still more good to come out of, you know, where we've reached today, which is the whole point of talking about all of this is like, how did we get to, like you said, how did we get to doing a podcast about being excessively Anglican? And why does that even matter for the modern day? And so it's strange that we're able to reach something good from so much infighting, but it's also nothing new. It's, you know, all throughout the Bible.
That's right.
You have people arguing and fighting, and it always comes around to being part of God's plan.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I would say that, you know, who knows what the end of the story is for the church. Do obviously new kingdom, we have the church back together as one.
Woo. Shout out to that.
Is it possible, is it conceivable that we could have a reunification of the church before the new kingdom comes? That you have, it starts out as one, there's a break some point later down in history. Is there a reunification possible down the road? I don't know.
You asking me?
I'm just noting it. It's sort of like a, because that would be so God to start something. It's a great narrative. It's just like the storyline starts as one, breaks apart, comes back together.
I could see it.
Yeah. But there are a lot of forces that are inhibiting that. Speaking of which, 20th century theological liberalism. And when we say liberalism, this is, we need to demarcate this from political liberalism. This is its own class of liberalism, which comes out of Germany and comes into England, comes into the States. And it's a reworking of the foundations for the faith. And it really is based on doubt, based on a disbelief in the core doctrines of Christianity. So the bodily resurrection of Jesus, that didn't happen. Maybe spiritually, maybe it was something that was like a metaphor, but it didn't actually happen.
See, I'm going to go ahead and dive in here.
Okay.
Hopefully without going too deep and losing people's interest. I've never quite wrapped my head around, and don't just agree with me. I mean, if you can give me a good answer, please do, because I want to be fair and balanced.
Yeah.
But if you're doubting these core tenets of Christianity, why would you still want to be a Christian?
Mm-hmm. So there are probably a couple different answers, and it probably depends on the person or the movement. But in the case of German theological liberalism, it was the Enlightenment coming into contact with Christianity, and it was also, I think, a desire to retain spiritual value and to dispense with what was beginning to be difficult to prove with science. Mm. So like people were beginning to challenge things like, well, there's no way that the Israelites could have survived in the desert for as long as they did because there wasn't enough. Natural resources would be pitifully small for such a great nation. And so they're beginning to ask scientific questions of the texts. And like, that's really the heart and soul of it is, this doesn't add up. This doesn't make sense.
I can't appreciate that. That makes sense why some people would feel that way. It's just very funny to me because I'm like, the whole thing that we're doing here is believing in God.
Yeah, which is crazy.
And so like, yeah, it is. And I've told friends of mine that are not believers, I've told them before, I'm like, yeah, it's crazy. Like, I'm not going to pretend that I can explain it or that I understand it. That's sort of the whole point.
Yeah, there's a lot of it that's enshrouded in mystery.
Yeah, it's it's crazy. And if you don't believe, sure. I mean, it's understandable to not believe. Mm-hmm. It's just strange to me, the sort of trying to make enough of it agreeable.
Yeah. Well, and you said, you know, why would someone stick with the shell of the faith and not just dispense with the whole? Humans are by nature religious. Like, we are just religious animals. Like, from
unpopular opinion, but I agree.
Earliest of days, and your religion can be an organized, like, faith oriented religion and like deities, or it can be a religion of like self seeking pursuits. Like, it's whatever you worship. That's ultimately what makes you human.
Bob Dylan said, you've got to serve somebody.
Yes, or someone. And you know, Bob Dylan was a Christian for like a brief period. Like, as a
Presbyterian, I believe that either he still is or he never was, but that's a topic for another time.
Fair enough. So where were we going with this?
Bob Dylan. No, wait, we got to talk about this right now. This is really important, not to the history of Anglicanism or this podcast, but you've got to know this. So Keith Green, right?
Yep.
You know, Keith Green's my favorite. Yeah. Keith Green is a Christian artist, like the hippie Jesus movement from the 70s. Yep.
Jesus Freaks.
He has a song on which Bob Dylan plays the harmonica.
Wow.
Yeah.
How sad and cool, but sad at the
same
time.
Yeah, kind of both. And I wonder what their relationship was like. It's a great song. Anyway, that's it. I just had to, that's like my favorite fact.
Hmm.
And so I had to share that. We can get back to the, you know, history of Anglicanism now, but don't you feel richer for knowing that?
I do feel richer for knowing that. So, yeah, you know, there's a comfort to having what you've known to be true. People don't want to dispense with the whole immediately. That's human nature. They want to have their cake and eat it. And so that's what happens with Christianity in the 20th century. You begin to have the hollowing out of the essence of Christianity while retaining the shell. And as you know, when you hollow out the core, the lifeblood of the thing dies. And so slowly but surely over the next 100 years through the 20th century, the Episcopal Church in America, just going straight to America here, begins to be hollowed out. Its leadership begins to question all these things. You have a disbelief in the Trinity, the bodily resurrection of Jesus. And your core theology doesn't just stay changed, but it then the downstream effect of that goes into things like morality, right? So you have, you know, questioning of same-sex stuff. You have questioning of gender stuff. The first openly practicing homosexual bishop was ordained in New Hampshire in 2003. So that was sort of the culmination. There was like a slow liberalizing effect of theology, which did not align with historic Christianity, that comes to full fruition by the end of the 20th century.
I think that it'd be worth reemphasizing again, since this podcast is ideally for people who are Anglo-curious,
yep,
and not necessarily people who are bought in. Not to de-emphasize that, but I think a common perception is that was the only issue.
Yeah, this is. Decades in the making of a slow drift away from what does it mean to be a Christian? What are the foundational things that we can point to that we can have common ground on? Well, the resurrection of the guy named Jesus, who's like the Son of God, is kind of the core of the core. When you dispense with that, you don't have Christianity anymore. And so you have this happening, and it's happening in increasing ways over the next, you know, the 1960s were a big flashpoint for all of this. There was a bishop, Bishop Spock, who came out with a lot of wacky theology. A lot of this stuff became really entrenched within the Episcopal leadership. And of course, you know, and I don't want to get too controversial here, but it's the 1960s and then really the 1970s that you have the first ordination of women to the diaconate and then to the priesthood and then ultimately to the episcopate or to bishops.
So that's something I wanted to talk about as well.
Yeah.
Because that is apparently also not one of like the main contentious points, because the ACNA, mm-hmm, which getting ahead of ourselves, sure, a little bit, but we still ordain women to the diaconate.
Mm-hmm.
To the priesthood mm-hmm. in certain and
not bishops.
Not bishops. Yep. Okay.
Yeah, that is a big topic. But yeah, let me get to how we got to the ACNA and then I'll jump to your question.
Cool. If that's okay. Yeah.
So you have all this happening. The moral distinctions within the Episcopal Church are affected by the core doctrines. When you disbelieve in things like core doctrines, it trickles down into how you understand the rest of Scripture. So like when Paul talks about particular theological implications for the life of a people, those don't have to be believed if you can disbelieve the core stuff. And sure. So really the Bible just becomes a historical document. It's no longer a theological foundation point. If the Scriptures are the source of our bearing on what is right and wrong, which is the ultimate idea behind morality, there's a good and there's a bad, then what is expressed in these words, which we believe are inspired, should guide that discussion. Should guide how we judge what is correct and what is not correct.
But like you said, if you don't believe that
Scripture is that source,
Jesus lived and died, then why would you believe any of the other parts?
Yeah. So 2003, Gene Robinson is ordained in New Hampshire, and it really becomes the straw that breaks the camel's back. It is the last point at which theologically orthodox Christians within the Episcopal Church look at themselves and say, we've been working to reform this church for like 50, 60 years, and it just hasn't gone. And it looks like it's only going to continue. There's a moment where you have to ask yourself, am I just deluding myself and thinking we can still turn the ship? And you have a jumping off point where in the early 2000s, a group of top leaders in the Episcopal Church say, as much as I would like to see this thing be turned around, I think it's kind of too far gone. And so you have the ACNA, the Anglican Church in North America, formed in the early 2000s. I think it's ratified in like 2009. But it's part of a global realignment within the Anglican Communion. We say the Anglican Communion, we mean like the worldwide fellowship of Anglican churches in different countries.
Because the rest of the world hasn't been changing the way that the American Anglican Church has.
Certain parts have, right? So you have like in England, a mirror sort of shift happens at the same time. But there are a number of churches in different areas of the world, especially African churches, Asian churches, that are very concerned because obviously the two historic epicenters of Anglicanism, both England and the colonies, now America, are beginning to lose their mores, their moral anchoring. And so what happens is this body called the Global Anglican Future Conference, or the GAFCON. It's the Anglican version of
Comic-Con. We're at GAFCON 3.
Yeah, exactly. They become a body within the body. So they become the orthodox expression of Anglicanism globally. And ACNA, Anglican Church in North America, is spawned effectively. The GAFCON leaders, most of them being from Africa, look at us and say, you guys, you need to do your thing. And so ACNA is established. That's a course sort of overview. There's a lot that happens leading up to it. And that takes us to now, because the ACNA has only been going for, if it was ratified in 2009, that's 16 years.
That's crazy.
It's very new.
So you don't really have people that have, I mean, some very young people, but you're not going to meet adults that grew up in the ACNA.
No. No one.
It's not old enough.
No one grew up in it. You have a handful of people, obviously, that grew up in the Episcopal Church that went with the ACNA.
Sure.
But what's different about this, whereas like with the PCA, PCUSA, you had a lot of people that are a continuation of PCA.
Right, which I was about to mention, that the PCA had a similar split in the 70s.
That's right.
And right here in Birmingham was the epicenter, Briarwood, now Presbyterian Church in America, huge church.
That's right.
They hosted everybody.
So, you know, getting that, all that is to say is that is the sort of the context for your question, because when the ACNA is formed, the main bulk of it is coming out of the Episcopal Church. And at that point, most of your Orthodox Episcopalians have no reservations about women's ordination. Some of them do, but a large majority of them, that has become normalized over the course of 40, 50 years, right? It's gone through a whole generation, and usually you get through one whole generation and whatever the thing is becomes normalized. So women's ordination to the priesthood especially is not so much a thing for Episcopalians coming out who are helping to found the ACNA. Now, there is a difference. You could sort of tease out the two pieces of this. There's a difference between someone who is convinced of women's ordination to the priesthood who still holds to a complementarian theology, and someone who is pro-women's ordination to the priesthood who holds to an egalitarian perspective of the genders, the sexes, where there is really no material difference between men and women. So those are two very different perspectives. But that first perspective is more predominant within those that leave the Episcopal Church. There are some that don't, but there's a majority that do. And then you have other people that come from other aspects of Anglican, like churches that were planted by African bishops in America. There was this thing called the Anglican Mission in America, AMIA. That joins forces, at least a subset of that joins forces with the ACNA. And so you get this hodgepodge of theological views, particular to this hot point question about women's ordination. There are some people that say the ACNA needs to make a decision on this. Like, we can't just like put these two together because it's going to cause some friction and some real issues. And then there are other people that are like, yeah, maybe in theory, but like practically, if we do that, that's two denominations. We're trying to create unity. Mm-hmm. We're trying to create a movement of Orthodox Anglicanism. And so the latter perspective wins the day. The ACNA is formed, and instead of making a call on this from a denominational down perspective, they make it a states' rights issue. So the diocese or the individual geographical groupings of Anglican churches over which is a bishop, each diocese is able to decide what its perspective is on this. And so, you know, for our diocese, the Anglican Diocese of the South, we support women's ordination to the priesthood, I'm sorry, to the diaconate, not to the priesthood, but the diocese that I came from, the Anglican Diocese of the Mid-Atlantic, DOMA, does support not just diaconate, but priesthood. And so there's a plethora of viewpoints on this. And the question for a lot of people is ultimately, like, where does this all go? Like, in 50 years from now, is everyone still pretty happy to live with the sort of what becomes a sort of contentious point for especially like the polar sides of this? Like, there's a pretty heavy middle group of people that are like, look, we might disagree on this, but as long as you're not like forcing me one way or the other, like, we can sort of figure this out. But there are always going to be people on the end of the polls that are creating a lot of friction. And so that's an open question for the ACNA of, does this get resolved in some way? Is there a third denomination that spawns kind of like the EPC?
Mm-hmm.
And the PCA, right? That's
right.
Sort of like a middle way that allows women's ordination to be an elder. I hope not too.
I always want more unity and not less. And for me personally, it seems it's like what I mentioned about like that would never have been the only issue that would have caused a split in the Episcopal Church.
Sure.
It had to be everything. So as long as there's no, you know, drift away from orthodoxy,
mm-hmm.
and that belief, that would be really strange, since that's the whole reason that it started.
So here's the question that becomes the inflection point question for this whole discussion. Where do you draw the line for orthodoxy? Because there are two generations of viewpoints on sexuality and ordination. The first that I mentioned earlier was this idea of a level of theological acceptance of women's ordination to the priesthood, but retaining a complementarian view of sexuality, like that men and women were created in Genesis to complement each other in mutually beneficial ways. The second generation view is that you have ordination of women to the priesthood, not because of complementing leadership, where you have like priests on staff that are men and women, and they're kind of like bringing their particular gifts to bear in the church, but because there is no ultimate, no difference between those two. That's a very different claim than the former. And for especially for those that hold to a theological anthropology, meaning a view of humanity that is inherently distinct, like distinctiveness matters, that's a point of tension. So that's ultimately, I think, a big question is where, because currently our archbishop, and I'm getting off topic here a little bit, but the newly elected archbishop is a complementarian in terms of his theology. In their diocese, they ordain women priests. They do not put women priests into a rector position at a church, meaning that they're the head leader of that church because of their view of the sexes. And so he represents a middle way, I think, within the ACNA between the two sides. The former archbishop was complementarian and didn't believe in the priesthood. This one is one step further down the road. But that's a question mark where, you know, the ACNA is going to have to figure out where it stands, not just in terms of its theology of ordination, but in terms of its understanding of humanity, because that's the real issue that I think is causing the friction points.
You know, what does it look like in the near future for the ACNA? Is the ACNA going to spread globally? Or are we sort of already an extension of, you know, you mentioned that there were African bishops that did missions to North America. Are we already sort of part of a global expression?
Yeah. Yes. But you asked, like, are we going to expand? And that the second answer to that question is yes. Because ultimately, the ACNA, when it left the Episcopal Church, left most of its resources behind. You know, the church I came from left its building from 1732. Left everything, even its general budget, the money that they had produced as a local congregation.
Because those belong to the greater Episcopal Church, correct?
Legally, it should not have, but it was judged to have been. And they left it all behind. And that's been the case for the majority of the ACNA. It's a poor, like in the grand scheme of things, especially compared to the resources that the Episcopal Church has, it is not a well-heeled organization. It's a sort of ragtag crew. And with that comes the need for what? Church planting. Because we don't have the ability to take seminarians fresh out of seminary and say, here's a job that you can go to at an established church. Like, that's happening more now, but it's still super early days. And so one of the fun parts of the ACNA, yeah, we have some issues that we need to figure out, like how to like live among each other well with. But put that aside, this is one of the best times ever to be an Anglican because there is so many entrepreneurial opportunities that are before us. And in our diocese alone, I think there are upwards of 20 church plants happening right now.
In our diocese?
At different stages. And we only have maybe 40 established churches. I'm shooting from the hip here, but those are rough numbers.
Entrepreneurial in what sense?
In the sense that we are breaking new ground with the gospel by launching new gospel communities, new churches. Church plants are happening left and right. It's a time for those that have some kind of apostolic gifting of wanting to build things. It's a great time to be an Anglican. And for people that are have been a part of a church plant, you know the experience. It's really hard. It's really challenging.
A lot of extra work. Sometimes physical, sometimes moving large boxes into a scary elevator.
Yes, that screams at you every time you press go.
Just hypothetically.
Hypothetically. So, yeah, I mean, it's a really fun time to be a part of the Anglican Church in North America.
Very cool.
Do we do it?
Yeah, I feel like I learned a lot of cool things today that I did not know about Anglicanism.
Are you now historically well-rounded?
I won't remember any of this until I go back and listen to it, but I'm excited.
Yeah.
A lot of cool things that sort of led to where we are, and I feel that excitement that you're talking about where we're going to go.
Yeah.
And as far as being excessively Anglican, we have so many more things to look at. I'm looking forward to next week. I don't even know what we're going to talk about yet. But I will have some kind of burning theological question for you.
What is that movie? I'm trying to think of where it's like. I don't even know what I'm going to be. You know, was this Anchorman? Brick Tamlin? Did you watch Anchorman?
I've never seen it. It's too millennial for me. Ooh. Never seen it.
Well, one day I'll give you a showing. It's maybe not the greatest language, but cool. Well, it's been good.
It's been great.
We'll see you next week.
Yeah.
Okay.
Come back. Listen again.
Closing out.
Signing out. Goodbye.